This is the Division 2, Division 3 podcast.
Welcome to the second Division 2, Division 3 podcast of the year. I am Matt Kinnear, joined by Josh Davey here in the Inside the Cross studio, and Kyle Devitt coming to us from IL North. An exciting, you know, I guess we'll call it week one of the season. We're going to have the week one media poll going out on the Inside the Cross website in a few hours here if you're listening on Wednesday. But really, you know, it's kind of a weird time. You have in the South some really significant games that are going to have implications and reverberate up until May. You know, these are games that might affect if a team gets in the NCAA tournament or not, where a team is seeded in the NCAA tournament, and, you know, how easy their path is to a championship. And then in the North, you have teams that haven't started games yet, teams that are just scrimmaging, or, you know, the NESCAC, teams that aren't even practicing right now. So it's kind of a wild time to be a Division III fan, but it's a really exciting time when you look at all these games that have happened. Kyle, how you doing up in IL North?
Doing pretty good. We're going to get to it eventually, but caught all of Lynchburg-Salisbury. So that'll be fun to talk about.
Will it be fun, Kyle?
Not for you. Not for you, but it'll be fun.
And I was up at York W&L, my old stomping grounds of York. I used to live there for about 3 years right after college, so it was fun to visit there, and it was a great game to catch in person and catch York and W&L, two teams that are going to be very good this year in the South. But I think that's kind of the overall theme is what we just talked about February games matter. You know, this York W&L game, I talked to Coach Brandon Childs after it, and he was very frank about, you know, I want to say it's February 9th and, you know, it's just another win and we still got a long way to go. But, you know, he couldn't help but just say, like, wow, this game is very significant for us. That's a game that W&L is going to be very good. That really can have huge implications on York's seeding. And York was a team that last year, in the seeding process, didn't get the seed that, you know, maybe they deserved, or certainly the seed that they wanted. So for them to get a big early season win is really huge for them. And that kind of transitions into, you know, what I think was the significant Division II game of the weekend, and that was Limestone beating Lenoir Rhyne 19-9. Limestone starts out 2-0 in the season. Lenoir Rhyne is a very good team. But, you know, they start 0-1, and they have a big game coming up this week. You know, so they kind of have some significant work to do in terms of getting one of these big early season wins. But I talked to J.B. Clark on Saturday night after Limestone got that win, and his message was, we're not back, but we're getting closer. He talked about this exact fact that, you know, look, this is going to be a team that we're going to probably play again in May. This is going to be a win that's going to have a significant impact on our season going forward. But I really am very high on Limestone. You know, the Faceoff yearbook, I had them ranked number 6 in the preseason. In the coaches poll, they were ranked number 14. I just don't see how you can think that Limestone is going to be down 2 seasons in a row with all the talent that they have. In this game, they won a lot of faceoffs. They won most of the faceoffs in the second half of this game. Offensively, you know, we kind of saw the Limestone that we're accustomed to. Matt Bennett is a really, really good talent, you know, attackman who's got tremendous indoor experience, played for OCC. And then Larson Sundown is a guy who just tore it up in juniors this summer. You know, right now, I know it's only February, but man, Limestone is looking like the team that could represent the South in a very crowded and very talented South. So definitely keep an eye on them. Sticking with D2, Merrimack, from what I heard from the scrimmages, they played against Yale this weekend. You know, Yale took it to them in terms of the scoreboard. Score was pretty similar to what, you know, Syracuse put up against Yale a few weeks ago in the Carrier Dome. But from what I understand, Merrimack was a little bit beat up, and Merrimack actually probably gave Yale at least a more significant physical test. You know, Syracuse sounded pretty flat when they played Yale in those scrimmages a few weeks ago. But Merrimack's a team that's going to punch you in the mouth no matter who they're playing. So, you know, it seems like at least they brought the intensity and brought the level of play up there when they scrimmaged them this weekend. But let's transition back to Division III and the York W&L game. You know, I was there in person, and it was, it was a sloppy game. It's February lacrosse. You know, there's certainly the new rules, I think, had some effect on that as well. But really kind of walking out of that game, it didn't really change my impressions of either team. You know, I went into there thinking that WNL was going to win the game because of their offense. York, I guess the one thing that did change my mind is just how good York's defense is. They have some new pieces. Their freshman goalie played really, really, really well for you know, the stage that he was on, playing in a top 10 game in his first start ever. Jack Michael, you know, he's a guy who we saw at the Inside the Cross Recruiting Invitational play for the Juice Cherries Club. You know, he's out there in the Midwest, and you know, the York coaching staff was able to connect with him at our event, see him. You know, he got the exposure that he needed, and then now he's starting for a team that's, you know, one of the teams on a short list to be a national championship contender this year.
Yeah, it's always great to see Coach Childs and Coach Dan Kaplan out at the Inside Lacrosse Recruiting Invitationals each summer. They do a really good job of being aggressive, and they're the guys who are talking to the club directors after games. I think they got a couple Juice Cherries guys. I've seen Coach Garland and Coach Kaplan talking often on the sidelines of Cedar Lane Regional Park. So excited that a guy who, you know, plays in our events got an opportunity to, you know, kill it over the summer and had an opportunity to play in a meaningful way and looks like to be the guy moving forward for the Spartans.
Yeah, Jack Michael was, he's definitely an energy guy. The one thing I noticed was he kind of went out there on the field and, you know, he was trying to get the crowd into it and was like jumping on his teammates before the whistle even started. So he's a guy that gets up and he gets down too. So, you know, kind of containing that energy and harnessing it in a positive way is going to be Coach Child's job. But man, this defense, you know, I joked, or I said on the podcast, I wasn't sure with a new goalie and some new pieces on defense how York would do, and Coach Child said that as soon as I went and saw him after the post game, like, "Hey, how about our new pieces on defense here?" Ryan Kennedy was a guy who had three calls turnovers, had a bunch of ground balls. Kevin Witchie guarded AJ Witherall. JD Beck was a guy who had a bunch of ground balls. This team was just kind of nasty and aggressive on defense. Really forced WNL into some. Into some passes and turnovers that like were just maybe a little bit beneath them. Maybe they don't happen in March, but they do in February. But I got to say, AJ Witherall, whenever he touches the ball, there's something about him where he just has the posture. He has the way that he moves, his size, his just awareness. It all looks the part of a guy who's going to be a Division III Player of the Year contender. So this WNL team is going to be very good. York got to do better clearing. 21 of 29 on the day. Part of that is February. Part of that is the 22nd clock. You know, so there's it was a game that was sloppy, but you know, my overall opinion of the teams don't change. York's defense is surely better than I thought it was heading into this game, or at least better at this point than I thought it would be. But in terms of the media poll, I don't know if I'm going to really change them that much. Maybe one or two spots. Also in the South was a game that both you guys watched pretty closely, and that was Salisbury versus Lynchburg. Kyle, I think you saw the entire game from start to finish. Give me your overall impressions of it.
Yikes! My initial impressions. Yeah, I mean, that first half, it doesn't get any worse for a team than it got for Lynchburg in that first half. Salisbury had the ball. There was some chippy play. There was, you know, some people on the sideline getting talked to. It was, I mean, I'm sure if you were there, it was a raucous atmosphere and tons of fun. But, I mean, it's not really that fun to watch a lacrosse game when only one team gets the ball, really. And that's, you know, Salisbury went up big and kind of coasted to the victory despite a 5-goal comeback in the fourth from the Hornets.
Yeah, I, you know. It's a tough one for me to talk about. No, I'm kidding. But the tale of tape, I think, is the efficiency on Salisbury's end. I remember, full disclosure, I was sitting outside of a Nordstrom Rack in Towson Mall with my dad while my wife and my mom were shopping, watching on my phone. And I remember Lynchburg going down 3-1 in the first quarter. And I remember looking at my dad and being like, you know, if I'm in the huddle right now and I'm Coach Kadoka saying, you literally couldn't have played a worse first quarter. You know, and you're down 2 goals against a really good team. We're fine. And things really only got worse from there in terms of the second quarter. But, you know, going back to the efficiency on Salisbury's end, they had 5 turnovers. They had so few turnovers. They were unbelievably efficient. Faceoffs were 14 to 23. Lynchburg only won 9 faceoffs. And it seems like they lost faceoffs at the most inopportune time. Salisbury outshot Lynchburg by 19, 49-30. Salisbury outground balled by 8. On clears, Salisbury 14 of 15. On man up, they were 3 of 4. So just across the board, they took advantage of the possessions they had, and they didn't give up a lot of goals. You know, Lynchburg, you know, their offense is, you know, to a, someone just watching is almost like a little like a three-man weave where they try to step in and draw slides and take shots, and they just couldn't get anything going. Salisbury sort of strangely just like blocked a lot of shots. A lot of shots just didn't get to the cage, which I thought was weird. A highlight for Lynchburg was I thought Chris Cornelius, who was making his first career start, looked great. He had 17 saves. He really kept them in that first in the game in that first quarter with 6 saves in the first quarter. So, you know, end of the day, it's an 11-9 game. Lynchburg figured it out late. We're able to win a couple extra faceoffs in the fourth quarter, going 4 for 6, which, you know, that's what it comes down to. Like you said originally, Kyle, if you don't have the ball, you can't put it in the back of the net. So, you know, it's funny how much we talked about Salisbury and their lapses, you know, in week zero, so to speak. But like we said, they're still going to be Salisbury. This is a great game, and you know, expect Lynchburg and Salisbury continue to, you know, be some of the top teams in the country moving forward. But yeah, the efficiency was a thing of beauty for Seagulls fans, not so much for Hornets fans.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty rough. Just even as a watch, it was look down, look up, Salisbury has the ball, look down, look up, they're celebrating. You know, it was that quick. It wasn't like the possessions were protracted to a point, but it's not like they had like 10 shot possessions, right? You know, there would be a save and an outlet. And then Lynchburg like barely got time in the six. I think that's one of the things that really raised an eyebrow is that, you know, they threw the ball away. They had some turnovers. They the Seagulls defense caused some turnovers on them, especially in that second and third quarter. I mean, it was just a question of momentum. And it is, I think what we're seeing, and this is going to sound like really John Madden of me, but if you have more possessions, you win the game. It's not even goals at this point, because the goals will come from the possessions because of the clock and because of the clearing clock. It's more like it's a race to see who can get as many possessions. And that's something that this game, you saw it a little bit in this game, but you also saw how Lynchburg used that to their advantage and came back, because Salisbury, you know, laid off the gas. I think they laid off the gas and gave Lynchburg a lot of opportunities to come back, and they took advantage of those opportunities. There just wasn't enough time. This is one of those games where it feels like maybe if there was another quarter, you know, if there was 5 quarters, we'd be talking about a great upset. But as it was, that the lead that Salisbury had was too insurmountable, even with the shot clock, which I think is surprising, but it's because of their possessions.
Everyone's
focusing on the clock, right? That's the big change. But it's also, the clock creates more possessions, and if you get 75% of those, you're just going to win. That's it. If not for Patrick Cornelius having 17 saves as well, this could have been rough. I mean, it was a shooting gallery at certain points, but, you know, weathering it and only giving up 11, I think is almost, you know, losses are not victories, but you can have victories and losses, and I think that's one of them.
And I think it was, like I said earlier, the inopportune timing of some of the penalties that Lynchburg had. It would seem like they would get a stop finally, you know, finally get some room to breathe, and a long pole would push it and throw it away, miss the point man. Instead of just like, hey, we haven't had the ball in 4 minutes. Let's take a deep breath. Let's get a good possession here. Let's run the shot clock down, work for a great shot. And then, you know, Salisbury would win 2 or 3 face-off, score a couple goals in a row. Lynchburg would get a slashing penalty. You know, it was almost like that quicksand. I'm going to shout out Shane Falco and the Replacements, right? It's like the harder you try, you know, the quicker you sink was sort of the way it felt at sometimes. You know, they were trying to make plays when they really just needed to, like, all right, we're going to be all right. We're going to be fine. Let's take a deep breath. We're not going to score a 2-point goal. Let's chip away at this thing. So I agree, though, Kyle. I think if there was one more quarter, we'd be talking about this game differently. But that's why you only play 4.
Shout out Shane Falco and the Replacements movie that was filmed at halftime. They had some of that filmed at halftime during a Ravens game. Some of the inside, I guess it was then PSI Net Stadium shots were there. So Replacements holds a special place in my heart. Classic movie right there. Kyle, you know, you have experience coaching in Division II and Division III up in the north. we talked about how this is a weird time with games going on, but, you know, some of the northern teams, you know, the schedule staggered. The weather is terrible in some places. It's terrible in Baltimore this week right now. What was your mentality? What were you doing at this time of the year when you were coaching?
I was cold and researching warm jackets. I think that the real difference with teams in the North is seen early, because there are teams that have indoor facilities and then there are teams that don't. The teams that do not have indoor facilities, which we did not have when I coached at St. A's, we did not have indoor. And when I coached at Daniel Webster, we didn't have indoor. But I think everywhere else we were able to get to indoor facilities. Franklin Pierce has a dome. So, you know, they're practicing right now on a fairly full-size field, or as close as you can get, I guess, with a giant dome. And that's really the difference. And actually this year, I think that's going to be compounded with the teams that have indoor access and a full field are going to be able to practice clears, and everyone else is going to be cramped and kind of practicing theory clears. You know what I mean? Like, in theory, this will work. In theory, this should get us over the half line. Because again, I think that's a big part of what's going to happen in especially D2 and D3 as opposed to D1 with the shot clock. Everyone's worried about the shot clock. I don't think it's been that crazy in terms of determining games. I think the one thing that you're looking at with a shot clock is resets, which I think refs at every level need to get better at calling. Because if it touches the goalie, are you calling it? Like, if it's outside the realm of going in, are you calling that a save for the goalie? If it touches a pipe, you have to do it. But sometimes people are missing that. You saw that actually in Salisbury-Lynchburg a couple times, Kudelka yelling for a reset that he didn't get. And it's not that the clock runs out, right? I mean, I think, Matt, wasn't it you saying in the Slack, like, if we could only keep track of, like, shot clock violations?
Yeah.
And if we could do that instead of, you know, just putting it as a team turnover?
Yeah, it was listed, and I'm not sure, you know, obviously the sports information directors and everyone, the statisticians are getting used to a lot of this new stuff. There's some, you know, there's some weird aspects to the clearing that I know a lot of sports information directors have talked to me about in terms of, you know, it's technically not a clear until there's 60 seconds left on the clock. So you could get it over midline with 70 seconds, but it's not yet a clear until it reaches that 60-second mark, if that makes any sense. And Kyle, to your point, I thought that they were a little bit too cavalier with calling resets in the York W&L game. You know, I think there were some that maybe hit the side of the net that the ref reset it. So there was more resets than I imagined. I didn't think that was going to be much of a factor with these new rules, but it was. And then, yes, with the shot clock, you know, I don't know if it's going to vary by how they input it into their software, but, you know, from a lot of the box scores I was seeing, they were just listed as a team turnover and not specifically as a shot clock, which made it a little bit difficult to just track, you know, how many times a defense forced a shot clock violation, because that was a significant aspect of this York W&L game. Was York did a really good job, especially late in the game. Just the defense was so good that W&L couldn't get anything done, and there was a few shot clock violations.
Yeah, you need to start recording blocks, too, if I'm going to nitpick all the stats and everything. But kind of getting back to your point, yeah, around this time of year, you're game theorying, kind of you're setting up your matchups, you're looking at, you know, your depth chart, all that stuff that you normally do kind of while you're getting ready for your first game. But you're also kind of like, okay, if you can't practice the longer field stuff like the clear, like true fast breaks instead of manufactured ones, you're trying to see how your players are adjusting to playing kind of farther out as far as they can go. Because on a field, if you're playing in a gym, like we would play sideways in the gym because we had to get the width, but the shots still came from up top all the time. So the rule was we couldn't shoot from up top. That's not good for your goalie. So you're making all these adjustments that like could help, but you're not always sure, because sometimes it sinks in with different players and sometimes it doesn't, the spacing and the distance indoors versus outdoors. But if you've got a facility where you can comfortably run, you know, everything in a full field kind of atmosphere, you're doing a lot better and you're actually ahead of all the other teams. Now there are, I would say up here, I don't know about the top 10, but I'm more familiar with any 10 teams because I literally live next to like three of them. I think that I would say it's probably 50-50 whether or not they're getting true indoor time. And I think you're going to see, especially in the first 2-3 games, which teams got that and which teams didn't. And you might see some wonky results because of that. But again, it's also a question of talent, and talent usually wins out, especially at the Division II and Division III level. But yeah, mostly just being cold and worrying is coaching this time of year.
And we have some significant teams that, you know, have yet to play. When you think of D2, Lemoyne, you know, they debut this weekend. Merrimack still has another week before they debut. Wesleyan, you know, and all that NESCAP group that, you know, we have so many high hopes for this season, Wesleyan, Tufts, Amherst, and many others. So there's a lot of good lacrosse to come. But on the flip side, Josh, playing at Lynchburg in the South, you generally had, within the first 2 weeks of the season, a really big game. As we've talked about, Lynchburg and Salisbury just played. So you kind of had this, you were thrown into the fire right away. You know, some of those you lost, some of those you had some, you know, some big wins. How does kind of this mentality of, like, you're going to start and you're going to play a game that's going to affect your season, how does that, you know, change what you do and just your mentality?
I don't think you can look at it so big picture. I mean, it's hard to, especially as a student, you know, as a coach, and Kyle can speak to that more, but as a player, you really, you know, while it's really hard to, like, focus one game at a time, of course, you're going to talk about, oh, you know, if we can beat Salisbury week one, you know, we're going to be ranked this, and, you know, then we're going to be able to do this. And now that I've been older, and once I was a senior, I didn't think this way. It really just has to be one game at a time, because, you know, we lost to Salisbury every time we played them except for my senior year, and we went on to be number 2 or 3 ranked team in the country after losing to Salisbury in 2012. So you really have to take it one game at a time. And to the point of the last, you know, 5 minutes, the national championship team hasn't even practiced yet. They don't, you know, they literally have not practiced as a team yet. So it's really hard to put a lot of weight into it. And mentally, you know, you're going to hope your guys are a lot stronger, you know, to take a loss. I mean, you're going to want to go into every game expecting that you're going to win. But, you know, the reality is there's wasn't one team last year who went undefeated. You know, you're going to lose games. You know, it's similar to, like, what I would say to my high school goalie. It was like, we're not going to win 4-0. Like, you're going to let in a goal. You know, you're going to have losses. It's just all great teams too. And it's, how can you take that loss and turn it into something better, right? It's learning more from a loss. And in the long run, you know, look at Yale. I think Yale needed that loss to Cornell last year in order to propel them to the national championship. So, you know, you really got to be short-sighted, have short-term memory, and, you know, just move forward. But it's tough as a college kid, and you want to win every game.
Yeah, I guess it's the coach's job to worry about the big picture and the player's job just to focus on the next day, the next practice, next game, next whatever, next opportunity you get to get better. So we get to look ahead. You know, we have the benefit of being able to do whatever we want. So we're going to look at this week's games. Tonight, if you're listening to this on Wednesday, you know, there's a pretty big, kind of the first big midweek game of the Division III season. We've got Washington Lee versus Christopher Newport tonight. We're going to go through, we're going to put our staff picks on our Instagram account and on our website sometime this week, but we're going to debut them here on the podcast. WNL, CNU, I'm going to go with WNL on this one. You know, I'm a big believer in the bounce back from a close loss is something that you can really come back from and really build on and kind of motivate you to the next game. I think CNU is a good team. I think this is going to be a close game, but WNL, I believe in Witherall as one of the best players in the country, so I'm going with them. Josh?
Yeah, I'm going with WNL as well. I think that having a big game under your belt already is really valuable. And it's cool, Matt, we were talking about the other day, going to get a cup of coffee, is I didn't watch any of the York WNL game, but I saw the last 7 seconds that you had tweeted out. And just watching Witherall carry the ball, he's just in a different level as most players. So I think going, you know, with him and the Generals, it makes sense. CNU loses about they graduated about like 150 points, I think. They lost the graduation. So I think WNL, with one game under their belt, the best player in the country, midweek, you're going to lean on your seniors there. So I'm going with the Generals. Kyle?
I'm going to go with CNU. One, to be contrarian, and two, because I actually think that's an exciting team. You know, that's a very exciting team going into 2019, and that's a team on the come up. You know, they had a really great season last year. And they return a lot of talent. Where do we have them ranked in the yearbook? Are they in the top 20?
CNU, I think they're like 11.
Yeah, I think you're sleeping if you think it's going to be a walk for anybody. But yeah, I'm going to go with Christopher Newport on this one.
Awesome. And I'm going to run through the rest of the games we have in our staff picks, and then we can all go through each of them. Lynchburg F&M is, you know, obviously Josh is going to keep an eye on this one, and we're all going to keep an eye on this one. I'm going to go with F&M. Maybe this is a little bit because I did a big feature story on them last year, and they ended up not making the NCAA tournament. But, you know, they still got a lot of guys back, and I'm a little wary about, you know, Lynchburg having the one game experience under its belt, you know, the big game experience with the Salisbury game. But I think I'm going to go with F&M in this one. W&L Denison is on Saturday. I mean, is there a team in the country that has more of a significant run to start the year than W&L? Basically, the same reasons I picked them against CNU, I'm going to go with W&L against Denison on Saturday. Stevenson, Ursinus, you know, Ursinus is a team that 2 years ago had a pretty good season. They had a down year last year. They got a new coach this year, so maybe this is a team that's kind of on the come up and can surprise some people early this year. Really curious to see how Stevenson is going to be this year. Heard some mixed stuff about, you know, their scrimmages in the off season, but, you know, I think on paper, really, they have everything to make a pretty significant run this season. And then RIT, Ohio Wesleyan, RIT is just too good, too talented not to pick them in this game. That's going to be on Sunday. Josh?
Yeah. Lynchburg and F&M this weekend. I'm planning on being in attendance. So this is a game that F&M won last year. They're graduating guys like Sean Rogers, you know, Reed Ziegler, some other guys who, you know, they count on a lot last year. Harry Rice, another midfielder. It's going to come down to the faceoff X. If Lynchburg can battle at 55-60%, I think they win this game. Again, I think there's value in having that one game under your belt, knowing the rules, understanding, you know, how big the game is, right? Lynchburg, we're talking about so much how big these games are. You know, they've got already got one loss. So I think Lynchburg goes in and gets the job done on Saturday up in Lancaster. And then what? Denison, W&L. I think Denison takes it W&L. I'll be interested to see, you know, how W&L comes back from playing a York, playing a CNU. I think Denison will be a little fresher. Everyone should be fresh this time of year. But I think Denison's one of those teams that doesn't get enough attention. They're very, very good. I'm looking forward to that one as well. RIT, Ohio Wesleyan, I agree. I think RIT has too much power. It'll be interesting, you know, the dynamic of Denison and Ohio Wesleyan, two really good D3 teams in the Midwest, and how they can, you know, get their season off to a great start. So, yeah, that's what I'm going with. Interested in what Sir Devitt is thinking up north.
So is this a must-win game for Lynchburg 2 games in, despite all of your talk about early season games and losses coming?
They lost all of these games last year and still won the ODAC championship.
Okay. Well, I'm going to pick them because I still think they need to win it. I'm going to pick Lynchburg over F&M there. I think I'm going to go with Denison. I think they, you know, they sneaky have a couple of Americans. You know, Peter Pitroff is one of our second team guys. Definitely a guy that can put up points. I think that W&L, maybe we gave them too lofty expectations. I mean, we're going to find out real quick tonight if that's true or not. So this might be an out-of-date opinion by the time you listen to it. But yeah, I don't know. I'm still going to go with Denison. I did not put them in my top 10 last week, and I rectified that this week. So I believe in them. Stevenson or Sinus. Let's say Northern Bias plus Smock Kids versus Stevenson. Not that Stevenson is a bad school, but you always go with the school with the Smock Kids up here. If you're kind of breaking a tie, which I think I am, but I am going to go with Stevenson actually. I think Canabin is one of the more underrated coaches. He's very active, in kind of growing that school and growing that program. And they, you know, they, even if they're not great, they have swagger, which is points. You get points for that. I think, not that it's important to win games, but I think that it goes to the culture and the idea of winning more than anything else. So I'm picking them. And then I'm going to go with RIT because I think, again, another team with you know, a ton of All-Americans. Midfielder Sean Nally is on our first team. He's a senior. They're looking to kind of pick up the slack for Kyle Killen graduating. But another guy like Matt, what's the name of the LSM that we love? He got drafted. He's playing pro right now.
The name of the LSM that we love? I can't think of his name, but
from RIT. It's a great name too, and we're blanking. It's not great. Eli Salama. That's what it is. Eli Salama. So they don't have him anymore either.
He got on my radar two falls ago, and last year I trumpeted his abilities, I think, every week on this podcast. And that is an all-time name, but we just, for whatever reason, couldn't think of it.
Well, we thought of it. So going with RIT, as my Siri keeps talking, because it's been recording the entire time, and I can't shut, I'm throwing it across the room. Here we go. All right. So there we go. All right. Shut up, Siri. Podcast gold, folks. I think that's my last pick. And I think they're all kind of important as games go early in the season. You know, we're looking at kind of setting the tone and getting into it while it's cold. Because if you get a rhythm while it's cold, it's pretty easy to maintain it when it warms up. It just, in my opinion, and I've seen that in teams I've coached, teams I've watched, and teams I've played on. You know, that's definitely like a big thing is the early season wins don't matter as much unless you're talking about positioning in your conference. But so many teams don't play those until later anyway, that it's not a seeding thing. It's a winning your conference thing for a ton of these Division III teams, especially. That's like what those teams exist for. You know what I mean? It's winning that winning the conference and getting a shot at the dance. You know, it's automatic if you win the conference. If you don't, then you have to worry about who lost to who and who you beat. So I think, you know, if you take that that out of the equation and you just win your early games, you're obviously in a much better position to succeed, come April and May.
Kyle, you talk about getting a rhythm while it's cold. Hopefully here in the Division II, Division III podcast, we will do the same. Right now, Josh and I are sharing a mic because we broke one. Siri is yelling at Kyle on the other end. So, maybe not quite in the rhythm we want, but, hopefully the content is good enough to deal with some of these technical difficulties. That'll be it for this week's. We're going to come back every Wednesday. Kyle also has another podcast that you can listen to talking more about Division One, the In the Crease podcast that he does with Dan Ayburn. That's going to be on Tuesday mornings. And we got a full podcast lineup for you every day of the week on Inside the Cross. So please subscribe in iTunes if you're not already. Please leave a comment and a rating for us. Also, if you want to support Division Three, Division II coverage and, you know, what we're doing here, we're trying to grow it. We're trying to highlight the sport, the three of us. Go to the Inside the Cross store on our website. We have the D3 Life shirts. Just kind of show that you represent D3, and we would greatly appreciate that. So we will catch you guys next Wednesday. Enjoy the games this week and this weekend.
This is the Division II, Division III podcast.